is a clinical psychologist and mixed-blood Cherokee Indian who has worked for 13 years with the Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakima Nation in Washington State, and for more than 4 years worked as a psychologist for the Indian Health Service. David is a singer-songwriter and a writer whose latest book is called Tessa's Dance, and he is also contributing for a forthcoming book on the historical trauma and racist mental health practices in Indian country. So welcome to Madness Radio, David Walker.
Thanks so much, Will. I'm so happy to be here.
David, thank you for joining me on the show today. And it's also very personally meaningful for me to have you here with me today because I'm also mixed blood Indian, Choctaw Indian, and the Choctaw and the Cherokee are actually historically very closely connected. Our ancestors were on the Trail of Tears together.
Right. And there were many trails of tears. And that's what we need to remember, because there were lots of journeys that people were forced to undergo, moving out of the eastern seaboard and being pushed off their native lands and into the hills and then beyond onto Oklahoma and those kinds of places out to Indian territory.
And these experiences are directly felt today in the mental health problems and difficulties in Indian country. And that's one of the things we're going to be talking with you today on the show. And I just wanted to ask you, how did your own sort of journey begin to come out to Washington State and work with the Yakima tribe?
Lewis Owens, who was a wonderful writer in Native Studies, I believe out of University of Oklahoma, or it might have been Oklahoma State, wrote a lot about mixed blood and the mixed blood position on the frontier between Indian and white, where I've really kind of arrived at a balance these days where I see myself very much on this frontier space that Lewis Owens refers to, where I really feel a strong kinship and a strong friendship and a strong sense of alliance. I don't, make a sort of formal claim to, some sort of tribal standing or this sort of thing, but I'm very identified with my heritage in that respect.
So let's talk about some of the impacts that colonialism and racism continue to have today on American Indians in the United States, because in terms of the economic indicators, the poverty, the kind of extreme social problems, and also mental health problems, American Indians today are really continue to be very severely oppressed. And that's one of the things I think that mental health professionals face when they're trying to address Native issues. And let's just talk about what is the scope of that problem? What are the challenges that American Indians are facing today?
Well, one of the things that happens when I begin to talk about these kind of issues is it becomes somewhat of a litany, almost a laundry list of problems in Indian country. And I'd like to begin by trying to send out my feelings of respect and honor for Native people in the tremendous strength and cultural resiliency that they've shown in the face of really relentless oppressive forces. And when I say that, simultaneously, I can turn to my elders, and I know that I would feel a lot of affirmation in saying that we have major problems in Indian country with, such a high degree of poverty, the highest degree of poverty of any ethnic class in our country. We have the highest suicide rate, especially among young people, where it's the second leading cause of death for American Indian identified individuals between the ages of 10 and 19. We can turn to other forms of violence, that being self-violence, and think in terms of the high percentage of Native women who suffer from violence, 50% higher than African-American males in the United States. And so these are just some of the problems when we really nip into that and we look at the mental health, so-called mental health practices that come towards Native people from the outside their communities, a kind of practice that comes towards them that in many respects disregards and disempowers their own cultural traditions and tends to revise history in terms of locating a pathology in their brains or in their bodies without respecting the fact of their psychosocial environment and what they're dealing with and the oppressive forces that come at them every day.
So you mentioned a lot of the problems that people are facing. What is the roots of that? Why is it that we can trace this to colonialism and to imperial expansion in the United States? How has that impacted the communities?
Eduardo and Bonnie Duran put out a book about 15 years ago called Native American Postcolonial Psychology, in which they proposed six eras of trauma, intergenerational trauma and grief, from invasion to economic competition to war, then we have the reservation period, the boarding school period, and termination period. And these can be sort of traced chronologically, but they tend to be very resonant with people in Indian country who see things going on with their Native brothers and sisters, especially in with respect to intergenerational effects in families. And these are the kind of things that people grow up with. So when we want to look at something, for example, that's been a really big subject of revisionist history has been the so-called genetics of susceptibility to alcoholism among Native people, which is a complete farce and a pseudoscientific idea. There's no truth to the pseudoscience behind that claim. But actually, there's a lot of truth to the idea that from a colonialist perspective, there was a concerted and conscious effort on the part of early colonialists to get Native people addicted to alcohol and to develop a market economy that they could distribute alcohol readily to. And that passed that susceptibility that we're talking about is entirely socially based and intergenerationally learned. That doesn't mean that it's not a powerful force. There's been some decent studies that have showed that Native people become involved in alcohol consumption, do so in response to feelings of powerlessness, that alcohol indeed makes them feel more powerful, or to sedate some of the reactions to the things that are going on around them, such as poverty and displacement, chronic unemployment, and many, many deaths. The life expectancy of Native people is the lowest among ethnic groups in the United States. So one thing that I have observed in working with Native clients has been the frequent deaths in family, close family, that ensue in people's lives over and over. These kinds of things go together, but the message from the mental health systems has typically been one of genetic susceptibility, inferiority, brain problems, this sort of thing. So that's the pseudoscience that's revisionist of that these colonialist events that have happened. We also do that same task of pathologizing them as individuals, of saying that they have children with damaged brains. And this is a kind of message that is not really a new one. It's actually an old one. It's the same kind of message that's been given to Native people for hundreds of years now.
So you think the mental health practices of today are essentially an updating of the same colonial racist practices that have characterized U.S. history towards American Indians?
In Indian country, the primary provider of health care is the Indian Health Service. The Indian Health Service is obviously connected with the federal government and is a descendant provider from the Public Health Service. The Public Health Service mandates that providers use certain best practices in providing services. And one of those practice standards is to let a person know if they come in complaining of feeling depressed, to let them know that they're suffering from a chemical imbalance. And that the first line of defense in that chemical imbalance is to provide them with an antidepressant. Okay, so this is a standard of practice. It's a very strongly based medical model approach. It also is completely fallacious with respect to the science behind it. It's a disregard of the lived context and the humanity of a people who have suffered oppression for generations. These are descendant practices that also have to do with the socialization of providers in how to think and what to think about with respect to providing mental health services. And it's unlikely that the federal government itself is capable of formulating or talking about an approach to that which it has itself inflicted upon Native people. So this is much like a perpetrator trying to formulate what's wrong with the victim. Part of the problem, what you see there in the Indian Health Service with respect to these very confined models around labeling people with DSM labels, labels based in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, as they get these labels, they begin to develop a sense of stigma amongst Native people, which we know interferes with attempts to obtain employment and other things. Those practices are descendant from the same practices that happened in the 1920s and 1930s. In fact, the same kinds of things that happened at the Hiawatha Asylum for Insane Indians, which was closed in 1933, the only lunatic asylum in the United States, so-called, that actually was specifically set aside for the incarceration of Native people.
You mentioned earlier about the suicide rates being really high among American Indians.
Suicide is especially high among youth in Indian country, but I don't want to ignore the fact that we have elder suicide and we have suicides among the general adult population. There's been a lot of thinking about that over the years, but not a lot of really effective intervention in trying to help reduce the suicide rates. I've been pretty actively involved at Yakama Nation in trying to work with the community to think about those kinds of issues. There are things that can be done, and there are things that involve a greater amount of community dialogue. What you see in particular is it's a very difficult subject for people to talk about. The grief and the level of hurt often doesn't get talked about. And so we have prevention programs that are out there. You know, I would really challenge those who are involved to demonstrate how their utility and how effective they've been, because I don't think that they've been particularly effective. Many of those programs are funded and overseen by the federal government and involve a lot of particulars and a lot of sort of homogenization, that's what I would call it, of models that are imported from other places where they don't really work in the particular community that they're being brought into. So there's been some effort through circles of care and other initiatives to improve the amount of dialogue with the community itself about suicide issues. I still don't think that there's very much as far as empowerment in looking towards the importance of culture and cultural restoration, restoring and strengthening cultural identity in relation to school and in relation to the tasks of young adulthood. Native youth have to very frequently talk about having to navigate in two worlds. And so they are susceptible to countering feelings of helplessness and hopelessness as they move up against systems that are chronically against them. And kids will very unfortunately give up. It's also true that we do have instances of cluster suicides where we'll have one or two kids take their own lives, and then because of the interconnectedness of the community, kids who are cousins or know these kids who are close to them will then kind of go over the edge and take their own lives. So this just adds to the horrendousness of the issue and the problem. So I don't have any, you know, sort of quick solutions to that, but I think we need to speak openly about it, and I do have the permission and support of the elders I consult with to talk very openly about this challenge in Indian country.
This has been a very difficult picture that we're looking at about this, the difficulties and challenges and the continued violence and emotional suffering that's going on in Indian country. And tell us about what is some of your vision and the things that you've been talking with other folks in Indian country about. What are some solutions? Like, what are some ways forward to move us beyond the limitations of a legacy of colonialism and violence and towards something that really truly starts to address what is one of the most shameful and overwhelming parts of the society in the United States, the way that we're treating American Indians?
My vision is a shared vision. My vision is a collaborative vision. My vision is that people who are from outside the communities who are coming in as allies need to work in close partnership and be ready to open their minds and their hearts to ways of thinking, ways of understanding behavior and feelings, and work in a way that's very friendly to the ways that are already there and the resiliency and strength that has been there through so many years.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is David Walker. David is a clinical psychologist and mixed-blood Cherokee Indian who has worked for more than 13 years with the Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakama Nation in Washington State. He's a singer-songwriter and writer whose latest book is Tessa's Dance, and he's also working on a contribution for a forthcoming book on the historical trauma and racist mental health practices in Indian country. David, tell us about your novel, Tessa's Dance.
Tessa's Dance is a kind of a, it is a form, from my perspective, it is a form of my effort to make intervention. And the intervention is not exactly going towards the Native community. It's going to people outside the Native community to alert them to the kind of issues and things that especially youth deal with on the reservation, and using the template of my own experience at Yakama Nation. So we have somewhat of a curmudgeon psychologist in there named Rhett Barlow. We have a strong-hearted, strong-willed Yakama Indian girl named Tessa Mian Anashatawit. That's my effort to put together a word from the Yakama language that would mean love child. So she's come from a tough background. She's been through a lot of traumatic experiences. She's been in the foster care system. And the two of them meet and form a fragile but important kind of bond between each other as they try to help her migrate through the world of Native youth gangs and methamphetamine and the kinds of things that she's facing on the reservation. Now, this novel really came about because when I attempted to write a nonfiction book, which was going to be called Speaking in the Borrowed Language, Mental Health Practice as Cultural Oppression in Indian Country, I made a proposal to a prominent literary agent in New York, and I told her of my design was to take Native American mental health literature and show how strongly it is disconnected with the experience day-to-day of Native people, with some rare exceptions. And I was going to do that by sharing some of my anecdotal experiences at Indian Health Service. And she strongly cautioned me that I was in line to be sued if I went along with what I was intending on doing. So she said, why don't you fictionalize your experiences? I decided initially that I was resistant to that, and then I got laid up by some health problems and got started on the book. So the book has been finished, and it's been, I'm very glad to say, I approached it with some nervousness in positioning it before my Yakima friends, but it's been received with a lot of good feeling, and people seem to really like it in the Yakima community itself. They feel that it really reflects the experience of at least some, if not a lot, of their youth and what they have to face. And Tessa becomes sort of a heroine who represents, in a way. And then for people who have no familiarity with the experience of Native people in a reservation-based community and their youth, it's become an eye-opener, I think, at the same time as I hope I've told a good story to people. It is somewhat of a thriller.
In terms of Native people surviving and continuing to grow and thrive and continue into the future, what are some of the strengths that they draw on? I think it's spirituality has been an important part. Can you tell us about what it is that helps the survival of these traditions and these peoples?
Well, you know, I don't really care what study you look at in Indian country that has to do, is more or less an overview study of what kind of works, quote unquote, with helping Native kids and Native families. But restoring connection, restoring cultural ways, reconnecting with one's heritage in a positive way, these kinds of interventions, anything that supports that kind of approach, that's the single strongest preventative for emotional and behavioral problems in Indian country. There's nothing really that approaches the effectiveness. If you want to talk about the so-called evidence-based movement, there's very strong evidence for restoring and supporting cultural identity and cultural connection and community interdependence and connectedness in Indian country. Very strong support for that. So everything that I tried to do as I worked on Niktawakt and worked in other ways has always been to recognize the strength of the community and especially the strength of eldership and the wisdom of the ways that have been there, even if those ways have to some extent been corrupted or been interfered with, leaving it towards Native people to figure out how to reconstitute and reformulate where they want to go in their future is very, very critical. There's a wide variety of spiritual ways and spiritual paths. It would be kind of a romanticized misconception from outside, if you're not familiar with Native people, to think in terms of, you know, some sort of Dances with Wolves fantasy along those lines, which Dances with Wolves is clearly a very strong fantasy. But at Yakama Nation, what you have is you have the Indian Shaker tradition, of which there's basically two kinds of styles of Indian Shaker movement, an amalgam of Christianity and traditional spiritual beliefs on Yakama Reservation kind of put together into one religion. It came through a series of visions that were had by a man named John Slocum in the late 1890s, and has taken off in not just Yakama in the Pacific Northwest, but also in many, many Native communities around the Pacific Northwest. We also have the Seven Drums tradition, or Washat Longhouse tradition on the reservation. And there's other traditions as well. There's people who are very strongly Christian, and there's a strong Christian community at Yakima Reservation, but it's not what's reflected in the sort of romanticized depiction in film that is sort of another form of a sort of eye candy revisionist history, although I think Dances with Wolves is a very pretty movie.
David, we've been talking a lot about the transformation and the potential for change in Indian country, and at the same time, what do you think that Indian country has to offer the rest of American society in terms of helping the rest of U.S. culture to go through change and transformation? What does it have to offer?
Well, I want to respond to that question first by mentioning just how offensive and upsetting it is for Native people to witness or see their cultural practices appropriated by people who are not part of their community and have no connection to their community. And this is something that people profiteer off of. People write books about the New Age shaman, the plastic shaman. I think people should be extremely wary of the idea that I would have any, I would approve of that or think of that was a good thing, because I think that's a very ugly phenomena that's going on. I think also, though, it's good to look a little bit beneath that and talk about the kind of longing that is being reflected when those kinds of movements and attempts at cultural appropriation happen. They're both an undoing of a colonial experience and what actually went down and what actually happened to people in Indian country, and they kind of another form of revisionism, but they also reflect a longing, a kind of desire to sort of a reverse assimilation. I wish that I could somehow, if you look at Dances with Wolves, for example, I wish that I could, you know, as a Euro-American, I could somehow become Indian, you know, thereby undoing the history of oppression and colonization that's happened. But there's more to it than that. I think also that my own experience, and this is just purely my own personal view and my own spiritual journey, is that Native people, indigenous people worldwide, people who we identify as the people who have suffered the most from colonialism and suffered the most from having to defend and retain and keep, even in hiding and at the risk of going to prison or being subjected to violence, have held on to ways of being human and ways of exploring life and learning about the world. For centuries and centuries, they've sustained these ways in the face of all this coming at them. And I think in that way, once you come to know some of these practices and some of the ways that people approach the world, they're so admirable that they can't help but affect you and cause you to see your own life and how you want to live in a different way.
I think also there's a way in which, you know, looking at indigenous cultures from the perspective of European culture, we can tend to romanticize those cultures and say, oh, well, the way that Native people were treated by the tribes, the way that they treated mental health problems, or the way that they dealt with conflict, or the way that they dealt with the earth, was always so much better. And if only we could just go back to this romantic reality. But actually, it turns out that cultures are cultures wherever they are, and there's good qualities and bad qualities, and things are complicated.
I remember having a conversation with Levina about child abuse, and I asked her, Kala, come on, you know, are you saying that there was never any incidents of child abuse, sexual abuse in the Yakima community prior to the coming of the Europeans? And she looked at me for a moment, and then she, as I recall, she told me, well, yes, occasionally, every now and then, there might be such an instance, but provided the elders were in agreement, the person who perpetrated that wouldn't live past sundown. So one thing that you hear from people among the elders at Yakima Nation is a very constant reference to the unwritten laws. And that's an important thing to think about. For example, there was no necessity, according to reports, of a policeman or a police-type entity. And so when police were brought in the formation of tribal police to try to force people, for example, to give up their children to the boarding schools, to forcibly kidnap their children. This was an entirely foreign entity. When people were arrested, to be tied up by handcuffs and this sort of thing was a foreign experience to them. In fact, the word Walik Aklama, which is the Yakima word for policeman, means one who ties another up in bondage. There is this romanticizing of what went on in the past in Indian country. I do think that we need to be careful to recognize people in Indian country for the real humanity that they contain and who they are when we talk to them and interact with them and get to know them. I had a mentor in graduate school who used to give us the caveat, you know, beware the tyranny of your benevolence. And I think that many of the things that come towards Native people from a mental health standpoint are tyranny disguised in the form of benevolence. So we have to really, if we're going to be conscientious, take all that apart and do the best we can to, in partnership and collaboration with Native people, to reconstruct it in a way that's suitable to them and seems to be a source of help.
David, we are just about out of time. Remind us about your book and also tell us how people can get in touch with you.
Sure. My website is tessasdance.com. That's TessasDance, all one word, .com. And if people want to write me, it's I have to spell it out for you. It's David Walker, all one word, DavidWalker, at anisahoni.com. And that's spelled anisahoni.com. It's a Cherokee word, refers to the Blue Medicine people who were the protectors of children.
David Walker, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thanks very much for having me, Will. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to an interview with David Walker. David is a clinical psychologist and mixed blood Cherokee Indian who has worked with the 14 confederated tribes and bands of the Yakima Nation in Washington State for the last 14 years and has worked as a psychologist for the Indian Health Service. He's a singer-songwriter and writer whose latest book is called Tessa's Dance. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Listen on the internet at madnessradio.net and on iTunes. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
The KBOO Community Radio Artist in Residence Program assists artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artist in Residence Program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. The deadline to apply to be the 2014 KBOO Artist in Residence is February 14th. More information on the Artist in Residence Program, including eligibility, selection process, and the application, can be found at kboo.fm/AIR2014.
It is 12 o'clock, and it's time for headline news.
With your KBOO Noon News headlines, I'm Jimmy Tardy. Workers at a Goodyear tire plant in northern France have taken two senior management staff hostage. Production manager Michel Tehely and director of human resources Bernard Glesser were in a meeting with union leaders when an additional 200 workers showed up and barricaded the men inside the meeting room. The plant is due to close. Workers had hoped to force the ownership back to the negotiating table to explore whether a new owner was possible. If a new owner cannot be found, workers say that they want generous severance, including, quote, an enormous amount of money. The workers say they will keep the men in the negotiating room until an agreement is reached. Thousands marched in Tel Aviv, Israel, to protest detention laws aimed at African migrants. Over the past decade, asylum seekers from Eritrea and Sudan have crossed into Israel. The new Israeli law allows authorities to detain such undocumented people indefinitely. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees has stated that the situation is making it extremely hard for people seeking asylum in Israel to remain until their claims are examined for merit. A law that will outlaw consensual homosexual sex in Uganda is on the verge of going into effect. The bill is only waiting for the signature of Uganda's president to become law. Strong international condemnation of the law includes threats of drastic reduction in foreign aid from the U.S., calls for boycotting the Ugandan tourism industry by Richard Branson, and criticism from Canada's foreign minister. The law was reportedly passed without a legal quorum, and it has been resisted strongly by Uganda's Prime Minister Amamba Mbabazi. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni could put pressure on lawmakers to remove some of the harshest clauses for fear of losing foreign aid. With 46 prisoners still on hunger strike and being force-fed, a judge has ruled that genital searches of prisoners at Guantanamo Prison in Cuba may resume. Asserting that the searches are necessary to protect the lives of the prisoners, they typically occur in conjunction with prisoners visiting with their lawyers. Among items recently confiscated from prisoners who were returning to their cells after visiting with lawyers are ballpoint pens and MP3 players with recording capabilities. Tune in every weekday at 5 p.m. for your volunteer-produced KBOO Evening News. For KBOO News, I'm Jimmy Tardy. This is KBOO Portland.
And it's time now for the Noontime Jamboree. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Crystal Ballroom, hosting American Roundup in Lola's Room tomorrow night, January 7th. Featuring Steer Crazy. Doors at 7, show at 8, and all ages are welcome. Details at mcminimans.com/lolas.
You've got me under your spell again, saying those things again, making me believe you're just mine. You've got me dreaming those dreams again, making those things again. I've gotta take you back just one more time. I swore the last time that you let me down,